how he wished he wasn't so goddamned stupid. "What's the matter?" I asked. But he just kept shaking his head and mumbling about how he was a complete idiot. When that was all I could get out of him, I sat down beside him and put my arm around his shoulders, trying to comfort him. He flinched when I touched him, though, as if I tried to stick a knife into him, so I let my arm drop again. "Hey," I said, "what's wrong? Did you drink too much? Are you sick?"
"You should probably go," he said, not looking up from the floor to face me. His voice had fallen to almost a whisper. "I'm sorry I had you over like this."
"I had a good time," I said, still not comprehending. "It's been fun. I don't understand. Did I do something wrong?" He looked up from the gloomy position he'd taken, and I could see that he was thinking about something. Behind those dark eyes, some unwanted thought kept floating by, like a fish behind glass, wanting to get out, to be free of his skull.
"You don't remember a lot of things, I know," Jared finally said, his voice shaking a little. "But I was wondering, do you remember this?"
He took my hand from my lap then, and held it in his. At first I thought he was going to share a memory with me, the way he had at the park, that he was reaching across again. But when no memory came, and his thumb continued to softly caress my knuckles, I looked up and saw him waiting for my reaction.
"We used to hold hands like this," he said, "when we were kids, even when we were almost 13. I know it must sound strange. So many other things that used to be normal you can't remember. But do you remember this?"
I shook my head slowly, but he didn't take his hand away. I didn't take mine away either, even though I wasn't sure what I was even thinking, if I was thinking anything at all. Holding his hand did somehow feel normal, but I wasn't completely receiving his message.
"Is it there now?" he asked.
"Is what there now?"
"That wall you told me about. The wall that springs up inside you sometimes."
"No," I said, shaking my head, even though I was starting to get nervous enough to almost wish that I had the wall there right now.
"I'm trying to tell you something, Aiden," said Jared, his voice growing smaller as he tried to admit something big.
Sometimes I wish I could go back to that moment and wake up right then, to understand everything again, so I could do the right thing, so I could say the right thing to Jared. But at the time, my head was still broken. After it became clear that I wasn't able to say what he hoped for, that I still didn't know my lines, Jared took his hand away from mine.
"I didn't come back to Temperance because I missed it," he said, his voice now flat as an iron. "I came back after my dad caught me with a guy and kicked me out."
"I thought you left because of your dad's girlfriend," I said, and Jared looked over to roll his eyes at the enormity of my stupidity.
"Jesus, Aiden," he said. "I made that shit up. His girlfriend has her own apartment."
He stood then went over to lean against the doorframe with his back to me.
"I was embarrassed by the truth, okay? When I came back here and saw that something was wrong with you, that you couldn't remember some things, I was afraid you wouldn't remember us. Like that. Like the way we were with each other. And clearly you don't."
He sighed, frustrated that I couldn't fill in the rest of what he was trying to say.
"Just go," he said eventually. "I'm sorry I had you over like this. I was being selfish. I was hoping if we spent time together like we used to, alone, you'd remember how you felt. Which was pretty dumb of me, obviously. We were just stupid kids back then anyway, weren't we?"
"Well," I said, but Jared lifted a hand.
"Please don't," he said,
still looking down the hall instead of facing me, as if one glance from me might set him on fire.
"I'm embarrassed enough. Just go, Aiden. Just go home, will you?"
I didn't want to leave with things so unsettled, but with him not willing to talk any longer, I did what he asked and stood, brushing against him in the narrow doorway as I pushed past. For a moment, a flicker of energy leaped between us, like it had when he'd reached across to me at the fountain in the park, and I stopped there, waiting for him to change his mind. When he didn't say anything, I shook my head, angry, and fled. After firing up the blue bomb and backing down the drive onto Cordial Run, I felt more sober than I'd been before drinking the six-pack. I stuck to the back roads anyway, drove slowly with the window down so that the cold October wind blew against my face as the red and yellow leaves of autumn appeared in the wash of my headlights. I didn't know how to think about what had happened, about what he'd said, and about that weird flash of heat and energy that had sparked between us. I was too surprised. By his confession, by the way I hadn't pulled away from him, even as I started to understand. I just sat there and watched him caress my hand like it belonged to him. And then, to top it all off, I'd said nothing after he told me a truth that obviously hurt him to talk about. I was the one who should have felt ashamed. He'd been open with me ever since he'd come back and made a friend of me again. But me? I was a locked door. A door even I didn't have the key to. When I got home, my mom was still up, reading in the living room, the room dark except for the light from her tablet. One of her nightly rituals. A chapter or two of an e-book before heading upstairs. Toby and Dad had made their way to their beds and were probably already off to dreamland. "Hey," I said as I passed the room, hoping she wouldn't stop me and see that my eyes were glassy, or smell the beer on my breath, and guess that I'd come home because Jared Doyle had semi-drunkenly held my hand while we sat on his bed, and he confessed an attraction to me. I couldn't deal with her prying into things even I didn't understand yet. Before I could make it to the staircase, though, she said, "Aiden, I thought you were sleeping over at Jared's tonight. Did something happen?" "Decided not to," I said from the landing, "so I can get up early and help Dad."
"Well, that's nice of you," she said.
"Why don't you sit down here with me for a while, though? I have some things I need to talk to you about." Here it comes, I thought. The lecture on drinking and driving. And of course she would know that I'd done that, because my mom knew everything going on around her, even when she wasn't there to see it with her own eyes.
"I'm tired, Mom," I said, and feigned a loud yawn.
Through the entryway to the living room, I saw the portrait of my suicidal grandfather eyeing me in the foyer, judging my bad acting. I made a face like I would come at his portrait with a large knife if he kept staring like that, if he kept judging. And to my mom I said, "How about tomorrow?"
"Now would be better, actually," she said.
But I was already halfway up the staircase, pretending I hadn't heard her. I'd sleep peacefully, I told myself as I got into bed, and when I woke in the morning I'd do work for my dad. And after that, maybe I'd get Jared to talk to me. If he would talk to me, that is. If he could. If we could talk to each other. Chapter 5. The Angel, the White Stag, and Other Spirits. "Sleep is a place a person goes to," my mother once told me. "It's not a thing a person does. It's a place where we go to find peace for a little while." I was a little kid when she told me that, and in the fog of my memory, I could still see her sitting in a child-sized chair beside my small bed, leaning over me as she spoke, her hands pulling my comforter up to my chin. I can't remember all the details. I was probably sick or unable to fall asleep for some reason, but I do distinctly remember my mom brushing my hair from my eyes and placing a gentle kiss on my forehead. I do distinctly remember that somehow, after her kiss landed on me, my fever broke, or whatever it was that had kept me sleepless went away, and my lids grew heavy, and then I fell asleep fast. Fell being the key word. Fell into the place called sleep, where we rest, where we find peace for a little while.
A white haze surrounded that memory now as I put myself to bed and pulled my covers up to my chin like my mom did when I was little. If I could have kissed my own forehead to put myself at ease like my mom could, I would have. Heavy eyelids were what I wanted. As quickly as possible, I wanted to feel myself being pulled down into the dark place of sleep, where I could find peace after a night of unexpected and worrisome revelations. Peace wasn't what I found when I did finally fall into sleep, though. A strange dream came instead. It wasn't one of mine, though, I could tell immediately. Maybe it belonged to someone in my family, or maybe to someone nearby. I had no idea. But wherever the dream came from, it swooped into my room on dark feathers, plucked me up like a baby, and carried me away to another world where the peace of sleep did not exist. A world where the scream of an engine burst in my ears, so close, so loud, it rattled my teeth, scraping them top against bottom. I blinked as I came to, and turned my head to either side, looking around slowly. A row of soldiers sat against the wall opposite me, their faces blackened with some kind of paint, their round helmets covered in netting, their bodies slung with guns, grenades, parachutes, their eyes heavily lidded with worry. Then gunfire began to chatter against the belly of the plane we rode in. That was what it was, I realized as I continued to scan my surroundings. And the bullets rang out like pebbles thrown against a window. One of the soldiers lining the wall across from me vomited, wiped his mouth with his knuckles, then looked down at his own hand as if he couldn't believe the hand had actually cleaned the spit from his lips without protest. "Out! Out! Out!" someone shouted, and the soldiers stood to form a line. "Out, out, out!" someone shouted again. And I looked out the open door of the plane, where the wind whipped through the entrance and ran its hands all over me. It was dark outside the hatch, black as black can be, but I could hear more airplanes ripping through the clouds around us, could see the flare of their engines, the shadows of their wings forming a bridge of darkness across the sky. A young man was sitting next to me, fingering the netting that surrounded his helmet like a web. "Out, out, out!" someone ordered again. And the young man stood, his eyes wide with fear, and went to the door as commanded. I stood with him, I don't know why. I just stood because there he was, a man in trouble. A man who stood despite being afraid, who looked out over the edge of the open door, or the sky, ruffled like the petals of a black flower, flowed by. To jump or not to jump? That was the question. And I went to him, this young man seized with a sense of duty that emanated like an aura. I took hold of his arm, and when he leaped, I leaped with him. Into the sky we flew, the wind whipping around us. I didn't think about why I was doing any of this. It was a dream. So I flew into the sky with him, peering down at the dark fields of clover and woods, where gunfire chattered, breaking sparks of light into the night, and people ran through the landscape like frightened rodents. Then everything stopped for a moment. The air itself seemed to pull us higher into the sky, to pick us up like a kitten by the nape of its neck, and return us to where we'd jumped from. Then it dropped us again without any warning, and suddenly, throughout the sky, hundreds of white parachutes opened. We hung there, suspended in the air like white dandelion seeds blown away from their core. And down below, below the soldier and me, a battle had started. A barn was burning, illuminating the night with its fire. There was a steeple, ringed by the low two-story houses of the village the church served. The men who had flung themselves out of the plane circled the burning barn and the bell-tolling church like moths attracted to firelight. Where was I? In the air. "You're in a dream," I told myself. I was in another world. Through the black air we drifted, until suddenly a gunshot rang out, and the young man I clung to grunted in pain. He held one hand against his chest, and when he pulled it away, he found blood there, hot and wet in the cool night air. Then we hit earth, stumbled, rolling against each other, and came to a stop at the edge of a woods where we lay stunned, looking up at the sky as the planes cut through the dark on their way back to England. That was where he came from, I realized. I could pick that up from the current of his thoughts, like picking up a leaf as it floated by on the surface of a creek. The impressions of his mind had begun to enter my consciousness, but the longer I held on to him, the more I became confused. Couldn't distinguish between his and my own feelings. Couldn't tell whose memories were whose. He'd been in England, training for this moment. That much I knew. I could see the months that had led up to his boarding the plane to jump out into the sky over a field in France. I turned to look at him lying in the grass beside me. As he stared up into the sky we'd just jumped from, the line of his jaw was chiseled against the night, creating a familiar silhouette. The profile of a face I somehow recognized. And I thought, he looks like my father. He tried to stand, got himself halfway up with a good effort of gritting his teeth and grunting. Then he braced himself against the trunk of a tree, pulled a cigarette out of his pack of rations, lit it, inhaled deeply, and exhaled a smoky sigh of relief. When he tried to move away from the tree a minute later, though, something squished inside his boot, the sound of bones moving through jelly, and he winced as pain rang through his body, crippling him momentarily. He stopped, leaned back against the tree again, and waited there, breathing heavily. In front of us, the trees thinned out and a field opened, spreading toward the horizon. A dirt path cut across the center of the field, leading toward the village I'd seen from the sky. I could still see an aura of light surrounding the burning barn, most likely a mile from where we stood, but I couldn't see the barn itself any longer. I could still hear the church bell tolling in the center of the little town, but I couldn't see its steeple. Instead, I saw the dandelion seeds of young men drifting toward it. I saw one float right into the flames, consumed in the barn's conflagration within moments, as if it had never existed. Click-clock. The young man beside me had pulled a toy from his pack. Click-clock was the noise it made when he pushed on it. This piece of metal painted to look like an insect. A cricket, the army officers called it. I'd seen them before, in the sad and dusty toy aisles of run-down stores and temperance that carried nothing but pieces of the past for purchase. Bubblegum cigars, wax lips, lollipop whistles, plastic rings, and crickets. Click-clock went the cricket in the young man's hands. Then he looked around, listening hard, but no crickets but the real ones chirping in the meadow answered. The patch of blood on his chest had spread and grown darker as we stood there. I wanted to do something, but I didn't know how to help him. And since he didn't seem able to see or feel me near him, I didn't know if any of this was real or just a dream I'd fallen into. I was somehow there, though, in this other world, even if that world didn't register my presence. "Where are we?" I decided to try asking. "Hell," said the young man after a pause, as if he'd heard me. His voice was so low no steam escaped his mouth. A second later, though, he said again, "Hell! To hell with it!" And I realized he was just talking to himself. I put my hand on his shoulder, trying to reach across, the way Jared had shown me I could do, to put myself inside him. And when I managed to slip inside his mind, I pulled back quickly, shocked by the sensation of the bullet that had cut through his flesh. It nestled in his body, a hot, hard thing, burning and burning like an ember. He looked up, his mouth open, not knowing what to do, not knowing how to feel about anything. The other men were either in hiding or running ahead to the village, gunfire blasting around them. "I should follow," he thought. "I should go to the battle." He tried to take a step in that direction, despite the broken bones in his foot, but before his second step, something appeared in his path, stopping him. A silvery white light floated in the field in front of us, moving up the path that crossed the field, coming toward us. The young man looked harder, squinting, and gasped when he saw a white stag emerge from the dark. a white stag with an enormous rack of antlers glinting in the night like a giant candelabra. I shivered, not from the cold, but from a wave of awe that overwhelmed me as a stag came to stand not 10 feet from us. It stopped near the edge of the woods where we waited with our backs against our tree, and looked at us for a brief moment before snorting and shaking its head from side to side as if it were angry, as if it were issuing some kind of challenge. A moment later, the stag seemed to rise into the air as it jumped past us, so close I could feel its ivory fur brush against my skin. Then it fled into the dark woods behind us. The young man sighed as he turned away from the burning village to look into the woods, where we could still see the white glow of the stag weaving among the tall silhouettes of trees. Instead of going toward the village, the young man decided to follow the stag's light into the woods. Holding his hand against the hole in his chest, he stumbled forward, the bones in his foot crunching beneath him as he groped after the trail of light that flickered in the white stag's wake. We chased after the stag for what felt like an eternity, but was probably only 5 or 10 minutes. I held on to the young man's arm, tried to balance him, tried to help him carry himself forward. Just once he turned to me and seemed to see me beside him, peering through whatever veil came between us, and said, "Are you my guardian angel?" "I don't know what I am," I whispered, which was true. "But I'm trying to help you." When he stopped to catch his breath, which rattled and flapped in his lungs like a frightened bird in a cage, the stag stopped with him. It looked over its shoulder at us, waiting patiently, and the young man thought, "Damn you, quit playing with me." When finally he gathered enough strength to resume the chase, the muscles in the stag's haunches flexed once more before it leaped again ahead of him. In a small grove in the woods, we found the stag waiting, seeming to ponder the young man as he arrived breathing in ragged convulsions with blood drenching his clothes. The young man blinked as he met the stag's stare, as if he'd been waiting for this moment all of his life, as if fate had conducted him to this time and place like an usher. The stag's eyes seemed to grow as the young man looked into them, becoming larger, rounder, darker. A person could walk into them like tunnels. He could hide in them like trenches, and no one, nothing, not shells, not gas or grenades, nothing would ever find him in there. The young man took a step forward, but fell as he attempted a second. A shallow stream trickled along the ground, winking with reflected light from the moon and stars above. The stream mirrored the glow of the white stag's antlers, too, as the stag lowered its head to the water, a cup of light blossoming in the night-soaked forest. The young man looked where the stag looked, saw the glinting stream before him as a man lost in the desert will see water all around him, the thing that will quiet his convulsions, the thing that will quench his thirst. "Drink," the stag told the young man, and the tips of its antlers touched the water, dimpling the surface, turning the creek into a stream of pure white light. The young man didn't know if he'd heard the stag or if the stag himself put its voice inside him, but he did as he'd been instructed. He crawled the last few feet to the bank of the creek, and there he leaned over to find his own reflection staring back at him. He drew closer to his own image, then even closer, until his face met the face in the water, the two merging into one, and then he opened his mouth to fill himself with himself. He would die there 10 minutes later, his body half in and half out of the creek, the reel of his life rattling to a halt, sputtering. I looked away, helpless, put my hand to my forehead and started to cry, even though I didn't know the guy. Started to wonder why I was there, and why I hadn't woken from this nightmare. Started to wonder if I'd be trapped here like a patient in a coma, dreaming this dream, whatever this dream was, for the rest of my life. A ghost forced to witness the lives of others without having one of my own. And later, when I had time to think about it, I realized that was what I'd been doing anyway. Going through life like a good zombie. Rise and shine, check off the boxes on the to-do list my dad always left me, then off to school, where I kept my head down and tried not to attract attention. An afternoon drive down back roads, looking for something I couldn't put a name to. A route to some place where maybe my true life existed. Then home again. Water and feed the cows. Dinner. Homework. Bed. Everything I did in the morning, done in reverse this time. The white stag stamped its hoof and snorted as I stood there trying to collect myself, and I looked up again, saw it standing only a few feet away. It dipped its head in my direction, and I nodded in return, as if we were either old friends or else cautious, uncertain acquaintances. Then the stag did the most surprising thing. It knelt down on its front legs and spoke to me. "Let me return you to your proper home," the stag said. Its voice sounded in my head, the way the voice of the living death tree seemed to come not from outside, but inside me. "This is not your time," it told me. "This is not your place. You have fallen outside of your own story." So I left the young man's body by the creek and climbed onto the stag's wide back, clutching its thick white neck to steady myself. When the stag heaved itself up onto all four legs again, I swayed for a moment, worried that I'd fall. Then it took off in a blink, jerking me backward as it carried me away, farther and farther, deeper and deeper, into the woods around us. Dawn had arrived without my noticing, and the morning light glowed red and bloody above me. Within the woods, though, every branch and leaf and mushroom ring dripped with dark shadows. The white stag's hooves were as loud as a herd of cattle. On and on it ran, through brush and trees, until we burst out of the woods and arrived in the back pasture of my family's farm, back in Temperance, back in the 21st century, where Sugar Creek trickled behind us with a few ribbons of moonlight still swaying on its surface. It was night here, on this side of the world, in this time, in my own story, and the stag knelt once again to let me off. "Your body is in there," the stag said, turning its gleaming ivory rack toward the yellow farmhouse, which looked like a dollhouse from this distance. "Go to it, and be careful not to wander so far again. The world is full of stories. You can get lost if you aren't careful. You can lose yourself if you are unaware. And there are some spirits who would like nothing more than to lure you out of your world and into another." "I've already lost myself," I said, and turned my eyes to the ground, ashamed for some reason I wasn't able to name. Maybe it was because I didn't know the first thing about myself. Maybe it was because I didn't know my own story from someone else's. And worse, I didn't know if I could do anything about any of this. The stag only pawed at the ground, its silver rack swaying slowly as it shook its head back and forth. "I will give you a piece of knowledge that may ease your worries," it told me. "You will find yourself again." Then it turned, slowly, as if it were a large ship changing direction in the middle of an ocean, and took off in a flash of light so blindingly white, I had to raise a hand to shield my eyes. Inside the yellow farmhouse, I drifted upstairs to the room where my body waited in bed with one arm flung above its head. And beside the bed, my mother sat in the chair she'd pulled away from my desk. She was watching over me with her eyes closed, elbows propped on her knees, hands clutching a silver pocket watch that had once belonged to her father, a thing that rarely made a public appearance, since my mom kept it on the nightstand in her bedroom. Her lips moved over and over, just barely, as if she were saying a prayer. Or maybe she was just repeating my name out of desperation, trying to call her son back to his lifeless body. Whatever it was, it sounded like a spell. It sounded like an incantation. And then, as I walked the rest of the way in, she turned from the body in the bed to look at this other me standing in the doorway as if nothing were out of the ordinary. "Now that you're back, she said without blinking. I suppose we should have that talk.
Chapter 6 A Map of the Stars. After I slipped myself back into my flesh, like a hand fitting into a glove, flexing and stretching my muscles to reawaken, I opened my eyes, blinking over and over, trying to take in my room, which wavered around me like it too might be a vision. I was still reeling from what I'd just experienced, but I sat up in bed with my back against the cool headboard, my knees pulled up to my chest, arms gathered around them, hugging myself, glad to feel something real and substantial. Beside me, my mom cocked her head to the side, curious, and asked, "What's the first memory you have when you think of us? When you think of me and you together?" I thought about her question for a minute, furrowing my brow as I concentrated, and for some reason, the usual white fuzziness that surrounded my memory whenever I tried to recall something wasn't making an appearance this time. "The library," I answered a moment later. "You loved the library," my mom said without skipping a beat, nodding, smiling fondly, clearly happy that I remembered this particular piece of my childhood, that I'd picked this one out when she asked me to think of a first memory, even if my memory of it was still pretty vague. "I used to take you there all the time," she said. "Tell me what you remember about going there. In fact, why don't you just show me?" She held her hand out, palm up, while the other remained on her lap, clutching the timepiece. I looked at her skin, pale in the moonlight falling through the window, unsure whether I wanted to do what she was asking. She knew. She knew about what Jared had shown me I could do. She knew and was now acting like it was somehow ordinary. After a few moments passed without me moving, though, she raised her chin in what seemed like a challenging gesture and said, "All right, then, if you won't, why don't I show you?" She leaned forward in her chair then, put her pale white fingers on my bare shoulder, and reached across. It wasn't the library my mother showed me, though, at least not at first. Instead, she showed me a day not long after I'd turned 13, the day after Mr. Marsdale died. All through school, the news was circulating. A heart attack while he was asleep the night before. Blam! His heart shuddered and he was gone like a snuffed-out candle. I sat through all the talk, in classrooms, in the cafeteria, on the bus ride home later that afternoon, listening to the ebb and flow of conversation around me, wondering if I'd somehow made it happen. Because I'd seen something just the day before. Something that worried me. And because of that, I wondered if I had some kind of strange connection to Mr. Marsdale's death. I wondered if what I'd done was something more than a prediction of it. A man in a black suit had come into our classroom the day before, had looked Mr. Marsdale up and down like a cattle buyer contemplating a possible purchase. But no one else had seen this. Just me. I realized that after I'd interrupted Mr. Marsdale during his lesson to say, "Mr. Marsdale, who's that man in the black suit standing beside you?" And everyone in the room had laughed at me behind their hands. I got a stern warning not to be disruptive. Then later that night, Mr. Marsdale's heart stopped beating. Somehow I felt like I'd done it, had made it happen. Would he have died if I hadn't seen the man in the black suit come to stand beside him? That awful man with stringy red hair and a beard that animals might have built nests in. He wore a wide-brimmed black hat with the smell of charcoal wafting off it, smoky and dark. Would Mr. Marsdale have died if I hadn't said anything about it? If I hadn't said out loud in class that I saw the man in the black suit standing right beside him? My guts twisted throughout the school day, and when I got off the bus that afternoon, I ran into the house to complain to my mother. I told her that I couldn't go back there. I told her I felt sick and didn't belong there with everyone.
"What's the matter?" she asked, her hands gripping my shoulders to steady me, her eyes pinched, shaking her head in confusion. "Hayden, where is all this coming from?" So I told her what I'd seen during history, how the man in the black suit had come into our classroom like anyone who worked at the school might have, like he belonged there. I told her how he'd looked Mr. Marsdale up and down as if looking at a cow going to auction, as if he were evaluating the distribution of fat and muscle in Mr. Marsdale's body. Would he be a good buy? I told her how I'd tried to call Mr. Marsdale's attention to the man in the black suit, and how no one else but me could see him, and how the man in the black suit had looked straight at me, tipped his hat in my direction before exiting the room, leaving me shaking at my desk, nearly breathless. When I finished, I looked up, choking on my tears a little, to find my mother staring out the window over the kitchen sink, entranced by something in the distance, across the creek, over in the orchard. She didn't say anything right away, but finally she turned back to me and said, "He must not have told his story true, then." "What do you mean?" I asked, blinking away my last tears. "Mr. Marsdale had a chance," she said. "Like any of us do." She stopped then, and her eyes started to look inward to a place where I wouldn't be able to reach her if she retreated any further. I had to prompt her to continue, asked her to go on, to keep her there in the room. "Are you telling your own story?" my mother finally asked me. "Or are you being told?" I didn't know what she meant, though, so I didn't answer. "One day death will pay you a visit," she continued. "But if you can tell the story of your life before death tells its version, if you can tell it true, you can maybe keep on living." "Mr. Marsdale didn't tell death his story?" I asked. "He might not have known that he could," said my mother. "He might not have known how to. Most people don't know that trick anymore." She looked over at me standing in the corner, and it seemed as if a breath she'd been holding was suddenly released, filling the room with the scent of peppermint and coffee. "Now you know," she said. "And you can use that trick one day if you want to. But the thing is, you have to tell your story true, and not everyone can do that." "Why not?" I asked. "Because telling the truth is the hardest thing a person can do." The next day, she let me stay home from school, as if I were truly sick. It was a day spent watching her clean the house from top to bottom, dusting, washing clothes and dishes, vacuuming carpets, feeding cows, filling their trough, an old claw-footed bathtub, with water from a red rubber hose. In the afternoon, we went to the small grocery store off the town circle, where I watched her pick out things we needed. Cereal, oranges, flour and spices, cleaning products. She spoke to everyone we came across. The checkout woman, Margie Wallace, the bank manager, Mr. Keating, several women in the temperance library, a one-room building with high, dusty shelves that surrounded an open area that held round tables where old ladies gossiped in whispers. They wore white gloves, as if they lived in a different era, as if it were still the 40s and 50s of their youth, and they were at a wedding party. They stroked my head, complimented my curls and green eyes as if I were a celebrity, but I shrank from their touch. They made me shiver. "This one's yours, Sophia," one old lady said, holding my chin with the tips of her fingers so that I'd look straight up at her line-mapped face. "The eyes will tell it." Another clucked her agreement, nodding her cloud of cottony hair. "Those eyes are yours," she said, "if I ever did see them." The women wore pearls and pastel dresses. They smelled of lavender and citrus, of medicine and dusty Bibles. When I pulled away from the old woman holding my chin, she looked at my mom and said, "Why, Sophia, he's sensitive too, isn't he?" My mother nodded. She smiled proudly, brushing hair away from my forehead, and in the next moment she looked down at the floor, as if she was also somehow embarrassed. My mom selected two books, one for herself, a mystery novel, her favorite vice, and one about dinosaurs for me. I'd gone through a dinosaur phase several months before, but I was now on to ancient Egypt.
"Ancient Egypt," she said when she found me paging through a book of myths at the end of our visit.
I nodded curtly. I was very serious about Egypt right then. Several nights before, I dreamed of a mummy climbing out of its tomb to chase me, and I'd concluded that I'd better get myself heavily informed about mummies in case the dream ever happened in real life. Which it seems my dreams could sometimes do. Sometimes it seemed my dreams could come to life right in front of me. So we went to the nonfiction section and found a book about the gods of Egypt, Ra and Osiris and Isis and Nut. They had the best names of any gods I'd ever heard of.
I liked the story of Osiris, how he was dismembered, how his body was cast to the corners of the earth, how his wife, Isis, journeyed to the world's darkness to retrieve his various parts to put him back together. I imagined her on that journey, alone, finding an ear, an eye, a leg or a finger, placing it in her pocket for safekeeping. One day she would have all of the pieces and she'd put him back together. He'd no longer be lost to her. It was all, in my mind, a ridiculously awesome thing to do. I loved it. We drove home that afternoon in silence, me already reading the book, my mother's attention on the road. From the spacey gaze in her eyes, though, I could tell that she was really elsewhere, in some other place and time beyond the car she drove. When Toby came home from school later, he complained that I hadn't been forced to go back after my meltdown. My mother told him to hush.
"You're both treated fairly," she said. "But sometimes people require different things for true fairness."
Toby didn't agree.
"Aiden's spoiled," he said, before running upstairs, stomping all the way.
And in a way, he was right. My mom favored me. Anyone could see that if they paid attention. When my mom looked at me, she saw a part of herself. I was hers, I somehow understood, just like the old lady at the library had told her. We saw things through the same eyes. After my dad came home from work that evening, we sat at the table to eat dinner as usual. Toby talked about the 4-H meeting he'd be attending later that week. He was going to choose a calf from my grandmother's stock after dinner, would raise it over the course of the next year as a project. I was still too young for 4-H, but the following year I'd get to raise a calf along with him. My dad wanted to see his boys raising cattle. He had hopes that one day we'd work the farm together, just like all of the Lockwood men before him. When he talked like that, though, my mom would shake her head and cast him a glance across the table.
"They aren't all meant for that," was all she'd say.
Then she'd look down at her glass of wine like she could see the future forming in its blood-red liquid. Sometimes my dad would argue. Sometimes he'd tell her she was just like her father, who Toby and I couldn't remember because we'd never met him. Our grandparents on our mom's side had died long before we were born, and even before that, my mom had once told Toby and me, after we asked why the house was full of our dad's family photos but none of hers, that she and her father had, as she put it, had a falling out. She said she had refused to speak to anyone in her family for nearly 30 years, and from that I learned early in my life that my mom was not someone to cross. She could carry a grudge for eternity. That night, my dad told my mom she was crazy to think she could see our futures spread out before us as if they were maps.
"It's foolish," he said. "The way you think you can control everything."
I remember thinking how odd it was that he'd accuse her of the very thing she'd just told him he was doing, trying to decide our futures for us. My mom didn't argue. She stopped talking and looked out the nearest window. This was how she'd get whenever she and my dad couldn't agree on something. And as she peered out the window at what seemed to be something far away, I felt like she might be doing exactly what my dad had said she couldn't. She was looking at our future selves as they rushed toward us. Here they were, the people we were becoming, about to knock on our front door, hoping they could undo the mistakes we were making at that very moment. My mom trailed her fork through her mashed potatoes after she turned herself back to the table. She looked up every once in a while to answer a question my dad put to her, or to tell Toby it was his night to do dishes. I could tell she was in one of her moods now, as my dad called those times when she'd turn inward, out of rejection of whatever was going on in front of her, or because something had called her attention away from this world. But later, when I asked her if it was true, if she was in a mood, my mother said my dad didn't understand everything he was seeing. "They aren't ordinary moods," she said. "They're moods that come on when I have a presentiment, a message about something that's going to happen." She said that whenever she received one of these, good or bad, she'd always feel a little tired and confused for a while after. When I asked why she'd get tired from that, she said it was from carrying all of those people around with her. "What people?" I asked. "The people in the future. You, your daddy, Toby, everyone in town. And others," she added mysteriously. "There will always be others coming," she said in the tone I knew meant she was trying to teach me something. "Mom," I said, frightened by these other mysterious people, frightened by the things she and I sometimes saw. "What are we?" "What do you mean?" "I mean, me and you. What are we?" She pursed her lips, already disappointed with her answer. "Us?" she said, shrugging. "We're just like anyone." When the sky darkened and stars began to appear, she took me outside to look up at them, tracing their alignments with one delicate finger. Hers were not patterns we'd learned in school, though. They weren't constellations I'd ever heard of. "That's the Rose Bearer," she said, pointing to what I thought was Cassiopeia. "And there's the little man, and that's the Oak Lord bringing him an acorn. And there, the one with its corner star blinking, that star is the Probable Stone." "The Probable Stone?" I said. Somewhere in the nearby woods, an owl hooted. "I've never heard of that before." She looked down and said, "You've never heard of the Probable Stone? What on earth are they teaching you at school, then?" "Nothing useful," I said, and she laughed, knelt down, put one arm around my shoulders. With her lips beside my ear, she said, "If you're ever lost and don't know how to get home, no matter how dark and lonely it gets, just look up at the Probable Stone, and it will show you the way back."
"How can it do that?"
"Why, you just push it 3 times and tell it a secret rhyme."
"What secret rhyme?" I asked, eyes wide with wonder.
"This is my home," she said, turning me around to look her straight in the face. "And I know it. Even if I go away, it'll still be here. If I lose my way, it's your job to show it."
"Will it really work?" I asked, starting to grow skeptical.
"The Probable Stone has never failed me," said my mother. "Whenever I've needed it, it's always been there."
"When did you need it?" I asked. "When were you lost?"
"That's classified information, Mr. Lockwood," she said. "Just trust me on this one. Look up there and memorize that map of the stars. If you ever need to find me, look at that star right there. Touch it 3 times. Tell it the secret rhyme, and it'll show you the way home."
The vision ended, and as it disappeared into wisps of smoke inside me, my mother's hand left my shoulder.
"There was a time," she said, "when I didn't keep things from you. But I can't keep you from being who you are any longer. I can see that now."
"Who am I?" I asked, hesitating, as if those words were a foreign language, as if I wasn't sure I was even asking the right question. I was still trying to understand the memories she'd shown me.
That conversation where she'd talked about seeing the future and carrying people around inside her. It was like no other conversation I'd ever had with her. I could now see these new pieces of myself inside me, though, could recall the memories she'd just shown me, and I kept touching them, moving them around, trying to push them into the right places in my puzzle. Some snapped into place immediately, but others remained elusive, floating free in the empty space within my frame of patchwork memories. "You're him all over again," my mom said, shaking her head like even she didn't want to believe what she was saying.
"Who?"
"Your brother," she said. "Your older brother, Seth." I stared at her for a while, unsure whether I should feel uncomfortable about my mom's thinking I was my dead brother reincarnated, or if I should seriously reconsider the idea of reincarnation. Especially now, seeing how everything else I thought I knew wasn't true. Could I be that boy in the framed photo that hung on the wall? That brother I'd never met? Staring across the living room at my suicidal grandfather? Sure, we had the same green eyes, the same curly brown hair with flickers of my mom's auburn in it, but otherwise, that boy was a stranger to me.
"I don't mean that you're him literally," my mom said, when my concern must have shown on my face. "I mean that you're like him. He could see things too, but at a much younger age than you started."
"I don't understand," I said. "What's wrong with me?" My mom shook her head and said,
"Nothing. Absolutely nothing is wrong with you, sweetheart. You're fine. But there are things in this world that aren't fine at all. Like that man in the black suit you saw when you were little. There are things in this world that you can see that are dangerous, especially if they notice you watching them."
"The young soldier in my dream tonight?" I said.
"No, not him," my mother corrected me. "He's your great-grandfather on your father's side. And that wasn't a dream. That was D-Day, the day itself. You went there, or were brought there somehow, maybe because you've been drinking alcohol tonight and it opened you up to the journey. Not a good idea, by the way, drinking, unless you know how to drink just enough to loosen up. Drink too much, and things like what occurred tonight can happen."
"You knew I was drinking?"
My mom rolled her eyes. "You reeked of it when you came home. I could smell you a room away."
"And what was it that happened to me tonight, exactly?"
My mom held me in a steady, serious gaze. "You went back to another time and place. To someone you're connected to in the past. Your great-grandfather. You went there through the world's shadow."
"The white stag told me I fell out of my own story," I offered. Then my mom nodded, as if yes, of course, the white stag had told me that. Only natural, really. Of course that was what happened.
"You're going to have to tell me more," I finally said, looking at her with a deliberately hard stare, trying to make her understand how much I needed her to talk to me about these things. "Otherwise, I'm going to go crazier than I am already."
"You're not crazy, sweetie," she said, drawing a firm line in the sand.
"I feel like it," I admitted. "I'm some psychologist's future famous case study in the making."
My mom laughed, but waved away that idea.
"I can tell you more," she said, taking a deep breath, sighing it out in the next moment. "But it's a long story."
"It's the weekend," I said, shrugging.
"You have plenty of time to tell it."
Chapter 7. Second Chances. "So what did she say?" Jared asked on Monday, after school was out and I had caught him in the parking lot. He was afraid to speak to me after he'd revealed his secret. I could tell by the way he'd frozen when I called his name, as he made his way to the bus instead of to my car like usual. I hadn't gone to his house over the weekend to talk about his confession. Not after riding the white stag. Not after having a dream that turned out to be a visitation as my mother had later called it. If I were to break it all down for Jared into the neatest of packages, instead of the ramble I went into after we drove to the lake, it would go something like this. She said that I'd gone into something called the world's shadow, the backside of here and now, and witnessed something that happened to my great-grandfather. She told me that I come from a line of seers. She told me that my brother Seth had been able to see things too. She said he died because he saw something he shouldn't have. And she said that after I saw the man in the black suit back in the 7th grade, she put a blindfold of some kind over me. A dust cover over certain memories and abilities, she'd called it. Which I guess sounded nice, at least in theory. She did it, she said, to protect me from seeing anything that might hurt me. What could hurt you? Jared asked after I'd caught him up on the state of my thoroughly screwed-up life. Oh, you know, I said, real casual. Harbingers of death could mistake me for someone who's died and take me to the other side too early. That's what she called the white stag and the man in the black suit. Harbingers of death. I mean, what do you do with that? So anyway, you were right all along. Back when I was a kid, I saw some weird shit. I saw the man in the black suit getting ready to take Mr. Marsdale to death. Whoa, Jared said as he leaned back on the causeway guardrail. Behind him, Mosquito Lake was calm. No waves chopped up and down today. The surface was a smooth skin of pewter water. That's a lot to take in. Makes me want a cigarette just thinking about it. I took a big breath and released it, then spread my hands in front of me, looking at the back of my fingers as if they belonged to someone else. Yeah, I said. I could use a cigarette too. I dropped my hands to my sides again and said, There's nothing I can do about any of it. We're all just who we are in the end, aren't we? Jared turned to look at the lake. A single gull skimmed the surface, searching for easy prey. I hadn't meant to say something that would remind him of what he'd admitted a few days earlier, but there it was, his confession, out in the open again, if he wanted to talk more about it. And bringing that up sort of made us even, considering how he kept reminding me of how much weird shit I used to see but couldn't remember. I don't know, Jared said. He still hadn't turned back to me, so I watched his profile, his eyes downcast, his dark hair curling out from the sides of the baseball cap he wore backward. I mean, something isn't right. He shook his head as he turned things over in his mind. You saw things even after Mr. Marsdale died. Now remember that. I was only around for another month or two after that happened, but that day in the park, when you showed me a vision of us still together in the future, that was a few weeks after Mr. Marsdale and the man in the black suit incident. So whatever she did to you, she didn't do it right away. I shrugged. It's been a while, I said. Maybe my mom's got some of her own memories mixed up over time. In any case, she said she's been letting up on her influence, that's what she called it, lately. That it's okay for me to remember again, now that I'm older and able to take better care of myself. But she also said not to bother my dad or Toby about it. She said it'd be best not to disturb them. You got your big boy pants on now, Jared said, finally turning back to me, laughing. But I'd still keep looking into things if I were you.